We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We are going to bring you a second tournament report podcast. The idea of these tournaments is for a couple of guests to share their reflections on a particular tournament, the lessons learned, the experiences they had. The hope is that by taking a micro look at one particular tournament, you learn lessons that can be applied more broadly. You can feel the feelings that the people had and learn the lessons along with them. I did a tournament report podcast with different guests in late June of 2023 on the National Open with some different amateurs. That one was well received. So we're going to do another one. And as long as you guys like them, we will do them a few times a year. This particular tournament is Alto at the Charlotte Chess Center in Charlotte, hosted by Peter Giannatos and his team, always doing groundbreaking stuff there. Alto stands for at least 21. So this is the rare tournament without scholastic players. It's kind of a one-off, although this is the second time this year they did it. I know that this is the second time we've done a U.S.-based tournament, and I definitely want to get a global perspective on different tournaments, so I promise the next one will be from somewhere else in the world. So to share their experiences playing in Alto, both at and away from the board, first up, we have friend of the pod, FIDE Master Nate Solon. A lot of you may read his blog, Zwischenzug, which is always insightful. You may have heard him before. Data scientist, FIDE Master. He actually won the tournament, which is just crazy. That's not necessarily the idea, but what can you do? Nate's good at chess, so he's got a lot of great insights. And the second guest is James Brandmeir. James has gotten into chess much more recently in the past few years, but he's all in on chess. I've exchanged a few messages with him over the years. He's reading lots of chess books, listening to lots of chess podcasts. He's even getting involved at the grassroots level where he lives in South Carolina. He had a decent result in the under 1600 section of the Alto section, as you will also hear him discuss. The last thing before we get you to the interviews is a call to action. So as I record this on Friday, September 8th, I just signed on the dotted line to make my first Chessable course. It's long overdue. I'm excited to make my own course. I don't want to say too much about the topic of the course, other than that it's tactic-based and it's for newer and lower-rated players. And I would like to use original material as much as I can for this course from amateur games. So actually, if you're rated below 1500 Lee Chess Rapid / Classical or 1300 USCF / Chess.com, I want you to send me your games. So they don't have to be brilliancies. They don't have to be annotated. I'm interested more in quantity of games than quality of games. So if you'd potentially like to have your games featured or a game or two featured in this course, please send them to me. My email address is ben@perpetualchesspod.com. In terms of how to actually send it, there's several ways you can do it. If you know how to email a PGN, you can just email me a PGN. You can also share a Lee Chess study or chess.com library with me. If you're playing primarily on Lee Chess, actually all you have to do is send me your handle there and I can get the games myself. I'll also, of course, be gathering games independently. Oh, and of course, if you have a file of tournament games, all the better. But basically, I want these games to be rapid or classical, not blitz. No bug house, none of that. But other than that, again, I just kind of like to sift through the games myself and find some cool material to present some ideas. So again, to review, if you're under 1500 Lee Chess, the 1300chess.com or thereabouts, it doesn't have to be exact, have some rapid classical or OTP games you'd like to send me, email ben@perpetualchesspod.com. And of course, that's my email address for other inquiries as well. So hopefully I hear from some of you. It would be great to get my hands on some amateur games. But without further ado, I want to get you to these interviews discussing at least 21 Alto down in Charlotte. So we got some fun interviews coming your way. The timestamps for when the interviews occur, as always, are in the show description. So first up is FM Nate Solon. Let's get you to it. And as promised, we are here with friend of the pod, data scientist, blogger, author of the new 100 Repertoire Ready One Knight F3 series, returned to his residence in Nebraska from Charlotte, and won the Alto tournament, by the way. Welcome and congratulations to FM Nate Solon. Welcome, Nate.
Hey, thanks. Great to be back, as always.
Yeah. And so for listeners, Nate and I had planned this before he went and played the tournament. And of course, my sort of vision for this new series of podcasts is to share the perspective of sort of an amateur player who goes and plays the tournaments, the ups and the downs, the lessons learned. So the vision of this series is not really that someone goes and wins the tournament. So Nate's kind of ruining it by going undefeated and winning the open section. But we'll forgive you, Nate.
Well, I think I told you before that, like, my preparation is what it is. And depending on how it goes, I'll come on and either say, like, why, you know, I was such a genius to organize things this way and like why everyone should copy me, or why it was a total failure and why everyone should do the opposite. So I guess this time we're living in the, you know, the first reality. I don't know if you believe in like the multiverse or whatever, but
right.
You know, things sort of broke my way this time.
Yeah. And you, of course, were one of the top seeds. So it's not a total shock. But I mean, you're 38 years old. You had your first kid within the past year, your first classical tournament since having a kid. So having been through that myself, remembering all the sleepless nights and the sort of feeling of brain fog that can develop when you have a baby at home, I just find it all the more impressive. Were you yourself surprised at, I mean, A, the results, but also like, how do you assess how you played?
Yeah, definitely surprised with the result. I did not, you know, winning the tournament was not one of my goals going into the weekend. It was more get back into the swing of tournament chess, catch up with some old friends, you know, get some experiences that would really enrich my coaching. Those were my main goals. Obviously I wanted to do as well as I could, but I certainly wasn't like going in expecting to win the tournament or anything like that.
And so I looked at your games. I could give my own impressions, but how do you assess how the games actually went? Did you just feel like everything was clicking or more like things just broke your way?
Yeah, not really. I would say it was like the games were fairly back and forth. I think my play was like, I would say definitely uneven, like pretty scrappy. I think I found enough good moves and like sort of fought hard enough to give myself a chance. But at the same time, I definitely wouldn't say my games were like smooth. I made a lot of mistakes. You know, I think there were a lot of spots where I could have played a lot better.
Okay. Yeah. And for listeners who may have heard my recent interview with NM Todd Bryant, that was a fun interview. So definitely recommend anyone check it out, especially if you're interested in improving your own game, if you didn't hear that one. But so Nate, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe you roomed with Todd there and also played him. And that game in particular seemed, I reviewed that one. It seemed pretty topsy turvy.
Yeah, that was very chaotic. And, you know, I really wish your episode with Todd had come out a week earlier, because I listened to that and it was great, but I did take note that he revealed that he had like some secret opening prep on secret online accounts, which I did not know about. We were paired in the second round. So we were, you know, 30 minutes before the round, we were each in the hotel room, each on our own queen bed with our laptops out, you know, trying to outguess what the other one would do. But, my read on Todd is that like he's an inveterate open Sicilian player and he just always plays his stuff, you know, and he has like thousands of online blitz games in these lines. So I was preparing my open Sicilian as black, and then he played e4, c5, 2, knight, c3. So all my prep kind of went out the window and he kind of got the drop on me from the opening. I mean, then it went on to be a crazy, crazy game with a lot of like really interesting tactics. I missed a fantastic defensive resource that could have been winning at one point, but it ended up being like I had just enough to, you know, I had some tricky defensive moves to force a perpetual check.
Yeah, it was fiery for sure. And in reviewing the game, I saw that it ended right, as you said, with a perpetual check right around move 40. But I couldn't tell the extent that the clock played in the game. How was your time management both in that game and more generally?
I think my time management was okay. I think I believe I was ahead on the clock in all my games. Although I would say, you know, on this one move where I missed this great resource, I think the clock played a role, not in that I didn't have enough time, but that like perhaps I was trying to play too quickly on that move, because I think I still had about half an hour at that point. But I had played my knight to b4 intending to go back to d5. He played a move allowing me to take a bishop on d3, but it looked like I couldn't do it because his rook and queen were coming in and it looked absolutely crushing. But I actually had, I could sort of counterattack his back rank and it would have led to a winning endgame for me. And I played that move knight to d5 very quickly, but I actually saw the resource with knight d3 just after I moved. So if I had paused for just a moment there, I maybe could have spotted that before and taken advantage of that. In general, yeah, I would say I was ahead on the clock most of the time. I was even, I was struggling a bit, I would say, with like how slow the time control was, just in that, you know, I haven't played a classical tournament in over a year, so I just wasn't used to like what I even wanted to do with all my time. I felt like, if anything, I was probably playing too slow, but my opponents were playing much slower than me. And there were like several moves where my opponents thought for like 20, 30 minutes plus on one move, when I thought nothing much was happening, just like normal opening positions. And so, you know, I was mostly sort of walking around, not at the board. But it did actually kind of take me out of the game. Like, I felt it was difficult for me to get back into the game and start calculating again after that. So like, one thing I have to think about is how I want to deal with those scenarios where my opponent goes into the tank for like such a long time. You know, do I want to sit at the board and try to calculate? Do I want to walk around? How do I sort of keep my mind in the game in those scenarios?
Yeah, this is something that I feel like has changed over the years. I know that I am Dean Eppolito was at the tournament. I don't believe you played him. But when I interviewed Dean, he talked about how, like, because he's still trying to make the Grandmaster title, he really, when he plays, he's really trying to maximize every moment. And that, you know, that includes away from the board preparation. But he was saying he also forces himself to think on his opponent's time. And I try to, especially as a time trouble addict, I've tried to sort of take that wisdom to heart. But as someone who's able to play instinctively, and I, of course, have learned, like you wrote a blog post about time management that I think about frequently and have learned from. So it's interesting how, like, there's, you know, it's hard to find the right balance, basically. Like, it's, you could either be too, you're so relaxed like you are that you move quickly and walk around, or like, you know, so obsessive that it's also counterproductive.
Yeah, I think, I mean, different people have different strategies here. I don't see walking around as like, you know, like a guilty pleasure or something that I do, even though I know it's a bad strategy. I think like it's just not realistic to be calculating at maximum strength for like a solid 4 hours without a break. So I don't think that should be what you aim for. You know, some people prefer to stay at the board more. Some people prefer to walk around more, but like, I don't think you should necessarily feel guilty if you're someone who walks around. I think, well, I mean, this is like a whole different thing about like time controls and like how long chess games should be. But my impression from this and every other tournament basically is like, no one I see uses their time. Like, no one actually uses all the time they have in a classical game to do real stuff. Like, people just sit there for like the first hour and then they start playing. So I don't like, I don't think, I'm not really seeing anyone who's just calculating like ferociously and accurately for all of their clock time. So I do think there's something to, you need to be able to relax between the games, during the games, at least to some extent, to be able to actually focus and concentrate in the moments where it really counts.
That's interesting. I'd like to hear a discussion between you and Dean on that, because having played him, I do get the impression he's working hard the whole time, and I know he works on his fitness, but to me it does, I mean, I understand, like, I'm someone whose mind wanders to begin with, so I do force myself to sit at the board, but I also understand that at times I'm not going to be fully focused and certainly not calculating, especially when it's my opponent's turn, but as you say, it's tough to know definitively.
Yeah. I mean, like, I've even heard, you know, Anand has said, like, you know, sometimes it's just like relax, see what they do, and then decide how you're gonna respond.
Yeah.
That's I've kind also of more like my approach.
Yeah, I've also heard advice like you calculate on your turn, but think more big picture on your opponent's turn. You know, there's all kinds of possibilities, and we're not going to be able to solve it completely within this conversation. So, but Nate, let's talk about like what it felt like to actually win the tournament. I mean, a lot of people listening, like we may win a section, but to actually win the open section of a tournament, that may be something they never experience. Is it like a major milestone in your mind, or is it just as one of the top seeds? Is it more just like things went your way? You know, you win $1,000 for it. So obviously nice, you know, probably basically pays for your trip at least, but not life-changing sort of thing. Where does it fall for you?
Yeah, this particular tournament had a sort of odd, surreal quality to it. Because especially, I mean, you know, just early on, I was just playing my games, whatever, you know, trying to score as much as possible. But especially going into the last round, because going into the final round, I had 4.5 points with one or two, or excuse me, I think 4 points with one or two other players. And Dina Belenkaya had four, she was in clear first with 4.5. But I had white against her in the final round. So it was like, you know, an absolutely must win scenario. I had to go all out for the win because if I won, I would win the tournament. If I drew, I would get, you know, second, probably tie for second. So it's like the most clear-cut must-win scenario you can imagine. But the way it lined up like that, you know, against Dina, who's like this incredibly like famous and like glamorous like chess celebrity, and with the white pieces, where like one of the things I was doing this tournament was actually using my repertoire for my Chessable course as a kind of, well, partly as a matter of practicality, since I already knew it and I had to prepare a black repertoire too, but also as a way to sort of test it out. I don't know. I just had this odd sense that everything was like cosmically aligning in a weird way. That was a little like, you know, it's like someone had written the plot to like the Queen's Gambit season 2 or something. It's like, this is all a bit on the nose. It's starting to feel a little weird.
And so we know you won the game, but like, how did you feel like your opening went in that game, and what led to that crucial victory?
Yeah, I think the opening, actually, The opening went well. All my openings, at least with white, went pretty well. So that was really interesting because I was literally just playing my chessable repertoire. So I was obviously concerned that my opponents could prepare because everything I was planning was completely out in the open if they just wanted to look at the course. I don't think anyone did that. I don't know if they weren't aware of my course or they just didn't have time or didn't have care or didn't care or what. But I did just use the lines from my course in every game, and I really got great positions from the opening, including against Dina. I got, she went for a sort of Slav type setup, and we went into a position that was like almost symmetrical, but I had a lead in development. We both had a weak pawn in the center. If I played it a bit more precisely, I actually could have won a pawn with a great position. So I could have gotten a huge advantage out of the opening. I didn't quite find the right sequence. But the way it played out, I had some nagging pressure that really kind of just, I was able to keep going through the middle game and into the end game. And finally, we went into this end game where I still just had a little bit of a nagging edge. We both got quite low on the clock. And finally, I was able to win this end game after we both made a few mistakes.
Yeah, the rook and pawn end game was pretty interesting. A lot of sort of a lot of subtlety in it, but it, you know, it did seem like you always had the upper hand. It just wasn't clear, like, are you going to be able to win or not?
Yeah, and it's funny as well because Eugene, like my co-author on my book, GM Eugene Perelstein, when I was talking with him about creating a training plan for this tournament based on the time control, one of his big points was you have to practice playing practical endgames under time pressure because that's what's going to come down to. Unfortunately, I ended up largely blowing off that particular piece of advice because I had a lot of struggles with childcare and other stuff leading up to this tournament, and I really had to pare down my preparation plan. So I tried to go with the win before the endgame plan, but against Dina, I was not able to do that, and it actually came down to exactly the scenario Eugene said. So I guess he was right about that one.
That's funny. Well, he was right, but you didn't have to do it, maybe.
I had one session with Eugene where we played some practical endgames in with like a rapid time control. And it was only one session. It was quite a ways before the tournament. But I think it actually, you know, it did help me because there's a certain feeling to playing those endgames on short time because it's a delicate balance between calculation, intuition, general principles, kind of juggling all those things. Like there's a real feel to it. And I wouldn't say it's my strong suit as a player by any means, but I think like playing those games helped me.
Nice. Yeah. And so Nate, age 38, you got a new USCF high rating. Congratulations. So seems like me and Todd Bryant might need to record an addendum because it's amazing what you're doing, especially in this potentially deflationary age. So mm-hmm. I know we've talked chess improvement before, but do you have any prevailing theory for why you're sort of able to sort of buck the odds?
You know, by playing in a tournament with no kids, I might have dodged a certain amount of deflationary pressure there. So there's always that. I think I would say I try to be like pretty creative and unprejudiced, I guess, in terms of like what works and what I do with my training. I think in chess, there's a lot of conventional wisdom, I don't, you know, old wives' tales, maybe, I don't know, old husband's tales, whatever you want to call it, of what you're supposed to do as far as training. I don't know how much of it is really right. I think blitz is good, basically, if you do it right. That might be one sort of contrarian take I have. I think some opening study is good if you do it right. I think for me, kind of being in touch with chess in terms of like coaching and looking at chess, even when I'm not specifically like working on my own game, helps me get not too rusty, at least.
Okay. And do you know what's next on your calendar? Are you going to get a chance to play again anytime soon?
I don't have anything booked, but I definitely want to because I was not seeing this as a one-off. I really do want to get back to playing somewhat. I don't think I'm going to be able to play every month or anything like that because it is tough for my schedule. but I would like to play certainly more than once a year. And, you know, I kind of figured the first tournament, if anything, would be the hardest. So now that I've done this one, I would like to like sort of keep the momentum going. And, you know, I think there's this sort of shape you get into when you play tournaments more regularly, where you're able to be more relaxed, more focused at the board. You kind of iron out some kinks in your opening repertoire. It really helps to play tournaments regularly.
When we come back, we will hear from Nate about what the tournament was like away from the board. We'll be right back. And we are back. Nate, so we've talked a lot about the actual tournament, but of course, part of the reason I decided to highlight Aalto in particular is we're friendly down with the members of the Charlotte Chess Club. Shout out to Peter and Grant and then the whole team. And I have played the previous one. I know it's such a pleasant tournament. Did you get to do much socializing in between rounds? Like, how did you treat that amidst this tournament that you ended up winning?
I did a little. So like you said, I was sharing a room with Todd. So that was cool. You know, we were able to hang out and talk a lot of chess. And I met some people I had already met or some people I only knew from Twitter. So there was one night where everyone got a free drink ticket at the bar. So we were hanging out. I had my friend JJ from Nebraska was there. So it was a little weird that we both went from Nebraska there, but we got to hang out a little bit. Actually, my plan going in was I was going to have that one free drink and no other alcohol was kind of my plan. I did get sort of peer pressured into a few other drinks. My friend Natasha Christensen, who I know from when I lived in Boston, we had dinner and she got everyone to order. This restaurant we went to had these old, like it was a smoked old fashioned. So they had some little gadget where they were like inserting smoke into the top of the drink and then it sort of like wafted off.
Nice.
We all had one of those. And then the night, you know, when the tournament was over, like I had a few beers with Todd and JJ and just kind of relaxing after the tournament. So that was fun.
Excellent. And I'm guessing not much sightseeing in Charlotte.
No, there actually, I would have loved to go over and see the club. So the tournament wasn't at the club, it was at a hotel. So I would have loved to see the club or some other stuff, but they're really, I mean, you know how these tournaments are with two rounds a day. There's really not a ton of time to get out and do stuff.
Yeah, makes sense. But overall, a positive experience, would you say?
Yeah, I would say it was great. I mean, I really asked around as far as what would be a great experience for me for my first tournament back. And so many people said this Aalto tournament was their favorite. And I would say it like, you know, it was as advertised. It was really well run. I had a great time and got to see a lot of friends. So it was a great experience.
Excellent. And as you've written about on your blog, and as you discussed, you got to play your repertoire. Aside from your own games that you now have played in one night F3, what sort of feedback have you gotten on your new Chessable 100 course?
It seems like people like it. Like it seems to be pretty popular. It's getting good ratings. So I think the reception has been positive, and I'm hoping I feel like this is a pretty good endorsement of it, because honestly, I didn't really know if it would work for me to play the lines, because this is not really a repertoire I designed for myself. It's not something I already played. It's really designed from the ground up to be a repertoire for club players. Like a lot of the choices are based on the online stats from amateur games and what works at more of an intermediate level. So there's that. And there's also the fact that it's very short. It's 100 lines total, which is like really quite a lot shorter than most opening repertoires or books. So in a sense, this approach is not really supposed to work at the master level. But it really did work. I mean, you know, I went in believing in the lines, but even for me, it worked surprisingly well. Like 3.5 out of 4 with the white pieces, a win against a grandmaster, a win against a woman's grandmaster. I'd say I got great positions from the opening in all 4 games. So it kind of exceeded expectations for me.
Yeah. And I should say, by the way, Nate has sent me the course and I checked it out myself. And I have to say, like, I get what you're saying about it. It's obviously less weighty than a lifetime repertoire. Those are voluminous. But, you know, you've written a couple times about how, like, you know, you can learn it in a short period of time. I still felt like it was deeper and a bit more concrete than I expected, maybe just from having heard you talk about it. I mean, it's a great course, but basically I'm saying I spent a few hours on it and I'm far from finished.
Sure. Well, it is. Yeah, I would say it's not really a system repertoire, meaning when you think One Knight F3, you might think of like the King's Indian Attack, where some people essentially are planning to play like the first like six moves, like pretty much the same, you know, Knight F3, G3, Bishop G2, Castles, D3, E4, like absolutely no matter what. That's not what I'm doing. There are some move orders, there's some move by move subtleties. You know, we're sort of reacting to different black setups to try to pose black some problems early on in different ways. So there are some concrete details that are a little tricky, but I do really try to like explain the motivation behind all that and like what we're doing in the course.
Yeah. And by the way, Nate, I know you'd also written about some questions about what to do with your black repertoire going in, particularly against D4. I know a bunch of people chimed in on Zwisch and Zug, your blog, offering suggestions you didn't necessarily want to reveal before the tournament, what you settled on in case you ended up playing someone. So what was the resolution of that storyline? Like, obviously the results were good, but what did you end up learning?
Yeah, so actually, both of my black games were really funny. I had four whites and two blacks in this tournament, so that was a bit of luck. But my first black round, we already talked about, was against Todd, where I had black, and I was expecting him to play the open Sicilian. You know, for this tournament, I actually never had to reveal which open Sicilian I was going to play. So
yeah, I was wondering about that.
I guess I could even keep that a secret, but honestly, who knows if I'll even be playing the same thing at the next tournament. And well, my whole white repertoire was like on my chessable course for anyone to look at. And I don't think anyone did. So you know what? I'm going to do a big perpetual chess reveal. I was planning on playing the Kalashnikov. That was my big plan.
Okay.
I was using Danny King's course on Chessable, as well as just some of my own research. So I was ready to play that, unless you're a future opponent, in which case maybe this is like an elaborate bluff that I'm doing right now. but I was ready to play the Kalashnikov. And then as far as black versus, well, I guess maybe I can just say like briefly why I was choosing that is like,
yeah.
You know, I think if you like to play like somewhat dynamically and you like to play for a win as black, the Sicilian's nice because you're going to imbalance the game. But I kind of like to go for one of the slightly more obscure Sicilians, because I feel like if you go for the Knight Orf, like you're really guaranteed to get your opponent's best shot. But if you go for one of the ones that's not quite as front and center, you can catch people a little more off guard. But like, there are a lot of good Sicilians, you know, like the Sveshnikov's great. The Kalashnikov, I think, is good. The Taimanov is fine. These are all good options. I went for the Kalashnikov because I think it's a little bit less move by move. There's fewer forcing lines where a lot of stuff gets exchanged. And it's a little more about like understanding the structures and how to play certain pawn structures, which I think suits me a little better. So yeah, that was my choice versus E4. Of course, Todd didn't go for the open Sicilian. He immediately went for this obscure Knight C3 and then Bishop B5 line. So it's pretty much scrambling like right away there. But, that was that. And then against, D4, I decided, I was going to go for the semi-Slav, which is an opening that I've always felt should suit me, but has never really managed to get it to work for me in practice, at least in blitz. But I kind of wanted to take another shot at it. And I was using Sam Shanklin's course for this. But this game was funny as well, because this was my other black game. And I had black against David Vigorito, who's an old friend of mine from Boston. Like, I lived in Boston for a while. He's from the Massachusetts area. So I had black against him, and my plan with the opening going into this tournament was to like prepare a narrow repertoire and just, you know, use it. So I wasn't gonna try to like learn some weird new opening to target my opponents before the round. I was just gonna play my repertoire. So it was all locked in. But the thing is, David literally wrote a book on the semi-Slav.
Right.
So it was like a little bit awkward that like I was locked into playing the semi-Slav against the guy who wrote the book on it. But I didn't, you know, that was my plan, and I didn't really have another choice. And he did go for one of the most like topical theoretical lines. So in the line he went for, I knew from the Shanklin course, I knew this like 25 move force drawing line, but not much else, because when I do these courses, I usually only do the quick starter, and then some, you know, I'll go back and fill in some of the rest of the stuff. But I really, in the full course, there's like a lot of details about what happens if white deviates from this line, but I didn't know any of that. So it was a very weird game, because I was playing quickly, like playing my side of this forced drawing line. David, I guess, so he wrote this book, but it's been a while. So he was going slowly, like finding his way at the board. But I didn't really know if I want, like, if he just played all the moves, it would be a draw. But if he played something different than what I knew, it might be a mistake, but also I would have no idea how to deal with it, and I would just have to figure it out. So he did end up deviating like around move 20. And I would, like, at that point, I was actually like so angry at myself, because basically at that, it was this insane imbalance position where I had no intuition about what to do. And like, I was really just like hating my life and like so angry at myself for how stupid my opening preparation was. And I did sort of start to go wrong a little bit, but then I found some good, like I kind of didn't play the best way. If I had reacted as well as I could have gotten, well, according to the engine, a big advantage, but the position was still very weird. But I was starting to get into trouble, but I found some good moves. I found like an exchange sack followed by a piece sack that looked very weird, but did turn out to be the best course of action. And if he had responded correctly, it would have been a forced draw. But at like essentially the very last moment, he chose the wrong king move. He could have moved his king in two different directions, and one would have led to a forced draw, but one lost, and he happened to choose the wrong one. So
yeah,
it was quite a weird game. It was sort of like the whole game was really compressed into just a few moves. That's how it played out.
I did see that game. And yeah, some of the backstory is fascinating, because I was struck by a few things just sort of when I played through the moves and was piecing it together myself. One, I didn't realize that I.M. Vigorito had written a book on that very opening, which obviously is an important contextual detail. But one, I was just impressed as I played through the moves, like how deep into theory you were, considering what you'd written about how you were making, you know, how you were designing your repertoire going in. And then, yeah, obviously, as you say, it devolved into that sharp position where he went King E1 instead of King G1, and it was GG's. But yeah, it was a fascinating game to follow.
Yeah, and he probably, I mean, the semi-Slav is an opening where you do have some of those very long forced lines. I think there's something like 37 lines in the quick starter for Shanklin. So like, you know, I know some people just use Chessable as like a book, like they read it once and like go on their way. I do actually do the spaced repetition thing. So, you know, that's why I was able to remember that line. But, you know, while I knew a lot of moves in that line, as far as like knowing alternatives or really understanding what was going on a conceptual level, my preparation was really not good in that case. And so that's actually something I really want to like improve upon. I think with the white pieces, because I designed the repertoire myself, I had a much richer understanding because I knew the alternatives I had considered and I knew why I made the choices I did. But when you do someone else's course, it's a little easier to just like remember the moves and sort of gloss over the details.
Yeah, for sure. It's a constant struggle. Well, Nate, as we wrap up, I mean, again, super impressive. Great that you got to have a good time and win the tournament as well. But nonetheless, are there like lessons, as you just alluded to, like one thing you want to work on increasing your understanding of new openings in addition to just sort of knowing some moves, but any other sort of takeaways of things you need to work on?
Yeah, well, so one is having like a deeper understanding of certain openings. And actually, you know, I think I came up with a sort of methodology that I'm going to try that I think is going to work really well for me. And that's just question and answer. So what I would do with that line, you know, when I go back and revisit it, so this comes from what I noticed is like when I was sitting at the board, I had a lot of questions I didn't know the answer to. Like, what if he does, you know, there's one move where like in the line I knew, I have this pawn that's hanging that he's just not taking. And I was sitting at the board and I was going, well, like, what if he just takes that pawn? Like, aren't I just going to be like down a pawn compared to the line?
I hate that feeling. I've been there.
So I think what I need to do when I'm learning and reviewing these openings is really push myself to ask more questions.
Yeah.
So for a long forcing line like that, what I want to do is actually force myself to ask a question on every move.
That's a good idea.
Either with the course or with the engine, or answer it with whatever means are available to me. And I think that's going to enrich my opening knowledge quite a lot. I mean, of course, that's going to be slower, but I mean, the thing is, there's not really like a free lunch when it comes to chess knowledge. Like sometimes it just takes time to get the knowledge that actually works. But you know, you were asking me about what do you have to do to continue to improve at an older age? I think this is like a great example of, you know, I'm not saying this is going to like single-handedly reverse rating deflation, but I think this is like, this is a studying technique that I think very few people are doing. I'm pretty confident it's really going to work for me. So I think it's really important to like be honest about your weaknesses, get creative about how you're going to address them, and like really kind of create some sort of training plan that can actually work. And often that's, I think what a lot of people are doing does not really meet that, hit that level. Like you can't just go through the motions.
Yeah. And it's funny because this has come up in some of my interviews. I always think of one with Grandmaster Hare Krishna in particular. And I wrote about it in my chapter about opening study in my book, but it's the classic divide. You know, it's still when I'm reviewing my moves on Chessable, it's like you really have to be hyper vigilant to make sure that you are in sort of an active mode rather than just rote playing moves.
Yeah. And you know, Chessable, I think this is a feature. I don't know how many people even know about this. Most people don't seem to use it, but there is actually like a question answer format built into Chessable on any position in any course. There's like a discussion thing. Like you can go down under the board and write a comment or ask a question and answer it. So I think I'm going to use that to, like every question or every comment I have, I'm just going to write it in there, and then like other people can interact with it. I think that's just like a nice way to keep my notes tied to those positions and to be findable where they're relevant, but also maybe to like interact with other Chessable users. Maybe they'll have some ideas that'll help me.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I'm aware it's there, but I never use it. And as an author, the authors probably appreciate it, because if you're wondering, probably someone else is wondering. And, you know, they knowing the answer, it's probably not a ton of work for them to explain an idea, and it makes their course better going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as an author, I definitely like the more people interact with it actively, the better. That's great. And I also just actually this morning, I just finished recording a video where I just went through the openings in my four white games and just kind of did a quick recap of like how my opponents reacted, how I played, where I could have actually improved a little bit, to just kind of, show everyone like how that repertoire played out in practice and go a little bit deeper into the middle games and how the games developed.
Nice. And is that for the course or for your YouTube channel?
I think what I'm going to do is I'll just post that on my YouTube just because that's a convenient way to host it. But I'll link it from the course and from everywhere.
Sounds good. All right. Well, Nate, I mean, like I said, it's really inspiring. I mean, it's really cool to see. I mean, obviously you're extremely knowledgeable, and there's tons to learn from your writing generally, but as you've alluded to, in your own writing, like to have you like in the arena and showing that it can be done, definitely, motivates someone like me. So, congratulations. And, thanks again for coming on. Do you have any, closing thoughts?
No, just thanks for having me on, Ben. I mean, thanks to the Charlotte Chess Center. It really was a great event, really well run. And I think everyone had a really good time.
Yeah. And I haven't checked in with them, but presumably they'll do another one in March. You know, Peter, I know they were right on the cusp of reaching 100 participants. Peter Giannatos, the founder of the Charlotte Chess Center, had been on Twitter saying if they got to 100, he would buy drinks. If they didn't, he wouldn't. Well, what was the resolution of that?
They did make it. On the night before the tournament, it was 95, and then I woke up in the morning and it was 101. I believe quite a few of those last second entries were in fact Charlotte Chess Center employees. So I think Peter might have put his finger on the scale a little bit there, you know, to get everyone a drink. But
I was going to say I thought he was bluffing anyway. But
yeah, we did end up we got our free drink ticket in the end.
Glad to hear it. All right, well, Nate, thanks again. And yeah, hopefully maybe I'll even see you at the next Alto. But if not, obviously, we'll be following you online as always. So congrats again and catch you online. Please stay tuned for a fun interview with James Brandmeir about what it was like to travel to and compete in the under 1600 section of Alto. We'll be right back. And we are back. And we are here with James Brandmeir. He is a dad, a newer chess enthusiast. He is the president of the Columbia Chess Club in, of course, Columbia, South Carolina, vice president of the South Carolina Chess Association. He, as we will discuss, got back into chess, or really into tournament chess, after the Queen's Gambit, but is someone that I've corresponded a bit with online. So I know that he's knee deep in it now. He's all in. He's reading books, listening to podcasts. I was reviewing his tournament history. He's playing a lot. So when I saw that he had made the trip from South Carolina to Alto, I thought he would be a good person to put a voice to a name and to hear the details behind this tournament. But first, let's welcome James Brandmeir to the podcast. Welcome, James.
Hey, Ben. Honored to be here.
Yeah, excited to chat with you. So we'll get into the Alto tournament itself momentarily. But James, you're rated in the 1300s. You had a great result. Congratulations, playing some tougher competition. But before we get into that tournament, could you just briefly describe, as you were to me moments before we started the formal interview, what got you into tournament chess in recent years?
Sure. Let's see. When I met my dad, he taught me how to play the game of chess when I was 10 years old. And I've always kind of known how to play since then, but never really took it seriously. I would always just do daily games on chess.com. But I realized that it was taking more time than I wanted to in comparison with a lot of my other hobbies. So I kind of decided to give it up with the coming birth of my daughter. And fast forward 9 months. I'm on 6 weeks of paternity leave, and the Queen's Gambit comes out. My wife knew that I used to like chess, and she wanted to watch it with me. And from there, while I was on paternity leave, we would play chess in the mornings and drink our coffee. And then I went back to work, and I wanted to play some stronger people over the board because I got the bug for it again. And that's when I met my coworker, Paul Copeland, who is related to National Master Sam Copeland, and he's a very strong 1600 player. And he got me up to speed with competitive chess, invited me to my first chess tournament, which was the Carolinas Classic held by the Charlotte Chess Center 2021.
Oh, cool. And Sam Copeland, of course, helped me out with the very first book recap, Mikhail Tal, back in the day, and has an excellent chess YouTube channel and knows his chess inside and out, in addition to being a strong player. And if you don't mind my asking, James, where do you and Sam's brother work?
Paul no longer works there, but we work together at Westinghouse Electric, where we make nuclear fuel assemblies for the fuel reactors.
Okay. Wow, that is heady stuff. Could Is it harder or less difficult than chess, would you say, James?
I would say that chess is a lot harder than making nuclear fuel.
Less dangerous, though.
Yes, definitely. Yes, a lot less dangerous.
Okay. Well, we're glad that you have found a safer use of your extra time. Now, so James, I was looking through your tournament history. I know you've been making decent progress and playing a ton. What prompted you to make the trip up to Charlotte for Aalto?
I just realized it's been a while since I had traveled to Charlotte to play some chess. Also, I kind of used Aalto as like a prep for our state championship next month. And I've recently started a study group that's been helping me a lot improve my game. And I kind of wanted to see where I was at. And as you mentioned, I do play a lot at my club. Every week there's rated games, but those players there are very used to how I play. So I kind of wanted to see how I would compare to a different pool of players.
Okay, that makes sense. And did you have like explicit goals, like certain things you were trying to work on, or more of a sort of carefree approach?
Kind of a carefree approach, because whenever I go to a tournament, I'm always kind of content with the fact that I'm never going to be fully satisfied with my preparation. Like, I won't solve chess before a tournament. But I have been working on being aggressive the proper way, or like how to gain an advantage. And so I kind of wanted to test that out.
How'd it go?
For the most part, it went well. I learned in two of my games that I need to pump the brakes and just kind of milk the advantage the right way instead of just going wild and sacrificing pieces.
Okay. Yeah. You had sent me your game against Scott Hanlon, which was a nice win from the black side for you. And obviously we can't go into too many variations, but I was impressed with this when you pushed Harry the H pawn. You know, there was basically a position where it's not necessarily called for, but in a very sort of alpha zero like fashion, James correctly intuited that it was a good moment to pawn storm his opponent's king.
Yeah, and in a lot of my games, I was really paying attention to the pawn structure and trying to just guide my pawns to kind of aim at my opponent's king, grab the center when appropriate, and as you're right, see the right time to push that H-pawn to open up my opponent even further and maybe even promote.
Yeah, and you mentioned, James, that you'd been to Charlotte before. What other tournaments had you played there?
I've played in two Carolina Classics. And I've done, I think, a couple G45s that they run on Saturday only events, and maybe a couple reverse angles. But my favorite tournament that I went to with them was the 2022 NC Open, which runs alongside the U.S. Masters.
Okay. Yeah, I've only been down there for Aalto so far, but I know they do a good job with all their events.
Yeah, Charlotte's really inspiration down here for us in Columbia. During that event, the NC Open, there was over 400 players from about 30 countries, and he was giving out either 20 or 30,000 in prizes. And I've met a couple of people that are going to be lifelong friends, probably.
That's awesome. And so when you go to Aalto, I mean, you had your goals. You described it as a warm up for the South Carolina championship. But to what extent is your goal like I think in Aalto in particular, because it's an adult only tournament and there aren't many like that, a lot of people might go, obviously we want to do well, but there's also a sort of social component. Did you have that in mind, or were you like strictly business going in?
I kind of put my club first before my own personal chess improvement. So another ulterior motive for going up to Charlotte is always to promote my club. And I definitely did that. I met a lot of people that used to play in Columbia, and they are really impressed with what they heard about how it's kind of transformed since COVID. And it was also pretty neat meeting some of the other social media influencers for chess, such as Dina Bellenkai or David Vigarito or JJ Lang.
Yeah.
And it was also nice to catch up with Peter while I was up there.
Okay. And of course, I discussed, so you're going to be on the pod after FIDE Master Nate Solon, who managed to win the tournament. But we discussed the night at the bar a little bit. Did you make it out to that occasion?
I did. I did go out Saturday and get my free drink since they hit 100 players at Alto and watched all the Masters play chess. And I just got to talk to him and take it all in. It was awesome.
Nice. But did not play any of them in Blitz for the occasion?
I did not play any of them in Blitz. Sam, I went up with six of my friends from the club. So there was Sam Copeland was there, Paul Copeland, my friend Sean Miller, who's been helping me a lot in my study group. There's also Blaine Huff I went up with. Robert Webb was there. All these people were from my club. There's a few other people from South Carolina there that I knew. And I've played Blitz with all of them, especially with Sam Copeland a lot. So I already kind of knew what I would be getting into if I wanted
yeah,
to
Sam's,
do that.
Sam's tough.
Sam was tough.
How long a drive is it?
It is only about an hour to an hour and a half.
Oh, sure. Wow. You know, typical northerner. My geography's terrible. I didn't realize it was that close.
Yeah, it's only about a 90-mile drive up Interstate 77.
Okay. And did you guys carpool?
So I know Paul went up with his brother and I went up with Sean, and Blaine just drove to the tournament every day.
Yeah, I wondered about that. It's like, yeah, moderately doable, save some money and, go back and forth. So James, so you play frequently. What's generally your approach to reviewing and deriving lessons from tournament games? And if there is an approach, have you gotten to it yet in terms of assessing this tournament?
So immediately after a game, I always plug it into chess.com's analysis and then add it into my library. And then I show some of my club mates the game. We have a Discord server with over 200 members, and we share our games, talk about them. I get some insights about what I did wrong. Because I don't necessarily put a lot of stock into the engine, because I feel like engines don't necessarily understand human chess that well, because I can understand like, oh, This would be a good positional move that would break up the position. But if it's going to be like a six move tactic, I'm not going to put a lot of stock into that.
Right.
And then as far as reviewing games, I just kind of like to look at what I did right. Maybe an instance or two, what I could improve. It's been less than a week since the tournament, so I haven't had a lot of time to review the games. But one of the games that I did lose was a King's Gambit. And it was against a defense that I've never seen before called the Cunningham defense, where after black accepts the gambit, then they immediately do bishop e7. That was out of what I knew. And so I kind of just tried to play it as a normal swashbuckling King's Gambit game and got burned for it.
Okay.
So I did read the chapter on that defense from John Shaw's King's Gambit book.
Okay. Yeah, it's tough to know exactly how much to emphasize, like when you have an opening you haven't encountered before. So do you feel like it was like, this is something that comes up a lot. Do you feel like it was because of the opening you lost, or was it just like the feeling of discomfort sort of set you down a bad path?
So when I saw that she was going to do, when she played bishop e7, I saw that there was nothing I could do if she wanted to check me on h4 and prevent me from castling. So I did the bishop c4 line. So if she did check me, I could just sidestep to king f1. And I felt like that was all I needed to do as far as being safe. And then I could continue my attack. And after reviewing that chapter from John Shaw earlier this week, I realized that I do need to play it more calmly, develop more of my pieces. And then I'll be okay.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, and as I recently discussed the King's Gambit with NM Todd Bryant, it's definitely live by the sword, die by the sword. But that lesson will probably serve you well in future games.
Absolutely. I will say that I was a little disappointed that I didn't get to play my Smith-Morra Gambit last weekend.
You got the swashbuckling repertoire, man.
Yeah, well, I usually play very solid, but my friends always tell me that I don't get the initiative well. So I have switched to a Gambit repertoire to kind of learn how to play with initiative.
And are you doing that with black as well?
The only gambit that I really play with as black is the, I think it's called the Godly Gambit out of the Karokan.
Okay. Well, how does that go?
and I'm not even really that well versed in it. It's just something I'm kind of trying to still grapple with. My friend Stanley Sun showed it to me. I think it's out of the exchange variation where white takes on d5 and you develop your knight to f6 instead of recapturing that pawn.
Oh, okay. Yeah, as this came up recently, again with Todd, when we were discussing the Halloween Gambit, I used to feel like I had a good handle on, you know, obviously the various openings, but I feel like there's so many gambits where like content is being designed, especially for newer players, that like, you know, if I face something dodgy, I don't necessarily think of the name. My ignorance is being exposed repeatedly, including with the Godly Gambit, which I am now looking up.
I did a quick search on it on YouTube maybe a couple of weeks ago, and the only real content that I found on it was from Gotham Chess. And
okay.
So I'll just play it if I remember to play it, and just review it with some quick computer analysis to see where I went wrong.
Gotcha. So King's Gambit, Godly Gambit, maybe need some work. You didn't get to play the Smith Mora. In terms of like phases of the game or broader lessons, is there anything else? And again, I know you said you haven't had a chance to review everything, but did anything like immediately leap to mind from what again, you gain ratings. Sounds like you had a good time. So it seemed like it was a good tournament, but nonetheless, we can always learn things.
I just need to learn when to sacrifice pieces, because I did lose two games from sacrificing a bishop. And I need to really just slow down and calculate everything and be more confident when I play something instead of, it looks good, and hope for the best.
Yeah.
I always get told that for my level, I play a very strong end game. So I'm learning that maybe I should just keep my advantageous position, and instead of once I get that advantage to just kind of milk it instead of just find that knockout and play to my endgame strengths.
Okay, so more patience in terms of transitioning to an endgame, but when you sacrifice, it sounds like you might play a little more intuitively and need to do a bit more calculating.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, those are very common. I mean, the latter especially, it comes up a lot. It's a very common pitfall to just kind of want to let it fly and see what happens.
That shooting from the cuff. When you feel like you're winning, it feels like you have to do that. And I'm finding that that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's good that overall over the, you know, again, reviewing your rating history, it seems like you've been making slow and steady progress. So, you know, as you contextualize this in terms of like your broader arc, like where do you see your game? And as someone who's immersing himself in chess, like how do you choose to spend your chess time?
I run my club. My club takes a lot of time because we, are serious about growing it and improving the Columbia Chess Club. We really do have an eye for pampering the players as much as possible. So that does take a lot of my time. And I'm sure all the other organizers can feel that. Focusing on your club kind of detracts from what you can put into your personal chess. I do study chess on my break at work, and that's usually about all the time that I can get for myself. Because when I come home, I can't really study chess because I got two young children and got to do family life. I do have chess students, so sometimes I can prepare for them, and that seems to be pretty beneficial. And I have my chess study group that meets on Tuesdays, but it's currently on a break while my daughter's in soccer. And other than that, I just play on Thursdays at my club.
Well, I mean, it's admirable to me that it sounds like you have your priorities in order. You know, obviously, we'd all like to improve our games, but it's not the most important thing in life.
That is true. That's true. Although sometimes it feels like that when you're in the middle of a game.
Especially, yeah. And especially after those tough losses, it just feels like what could be more important. But so again, I appreciate that you don't have a ton of time to study and, you know, that you're prioritizing your family when you get home from work. But is it a tough conversation if you ask your significant other about going away for a tournament for a weekend like Alto, or is your wife pretty supportive?
My wife is very supportive about me doing chess as long as I also make time for family and my other responsibilities. So like I said, it'd been a while since I've traveled for a tournament. I think it'd been at least a year, because my son's a year old now, and I think my last one was before he was born. And so she was kind of excited for me to go. And I did invite her to come up with me, but she said that it would just be easier for her to stay home.
Yeah. Has she ever brought the kids to her?
She's brought, when it was just my daughter, she would bring my daughter and we would go do fun things in between rounds.
Okay.
But with two, it's seeming like that would be too much.
Yeah, totally understandable. And did you, I mean, it sounds like you've been to Charlotte before now, and probably even, you know, being that it's so close, I'm guessing you've been there even in a non-chess capacity. Did you try to do anything away from the tournament? Did you go out for any meals, anything like that?
Oh, yeah. Most of, I went out to the original Pancake House, which is right next door to the hotel. Went there like every morning. That was really good. Most of my friends, we ate lunch together. I know we ate dinner at the Chinese place, Baoding, which is around the corner from that hotel as well. And I also got to meet someone pretty cool from the chess dojo. His name is Sean McIntosh.
Okay.
So he's just another student. He played in the championship section, and it was very cool to get to meet him, because I just put in the dojo's Discord that, hey, I'm going here, I'm really excited. And he saw that message and said, hey, I'm going to be there too, let's meet up. And so he ate dinner with us, and we had a good night talking about chess. And my brother also lives in Charlotte, so on the way home after the tournament, I got to eat dinner with him at a funny place called Cowfish. It's a place that
I've been
sells.
There. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. So it was pretty good. It's a place that sells burgers and sushi. I didn't think that would be a combination that sounded good, but it was.
Yeah. My one time at Alto, I had a meal there. Yeah. And it was excellent. Definitely recommend Cowfish. And the last topic, James, for you, I believe, is, of course, the, you know, Charlotte's doing great tournaments, full stop, innovative. And, you know, as listeners who've heard my interviews with FM, Peter Giannatos would be aware. But obviously the calling card of this particular tournament, at least 21, is that it's the rare tournament that's not overrun with kids. So I'm curious, A, if that like factored into your decision to attend, and B, if you could describe if it felt different because of that.
It definitely felt different because there were not children at the event. The kids at tournaments will invariably, or inevitably, I should say, kind of be distracting, even if they're not doing it on purpose. So the typical distractions that children bring, having the absence of that was very nice. And also, it was a little bit appealing coming into a tournament where I felt like my opposition would be at the strength level that their rating kind of reflects, instead of playing someone severely underrated.
Yeah, Nate Solong kind of danced around that topic as well. And I do want to say, of course, you know, children are the future. They're the lifeblood of chess. We want them playing. And I know Peter has said in other interviews that they're not looking to divide the chess community. And I support that sentiment as well. So I don't think that we should be having exclusively adult only tournaments, but it does provide a nice break in my opinion.
Yeah, it is a very nice novelty event. I wish that while they weren't necessarily more often, I would like to see like different organizations having their own version of one though.
Well, maybe in Colombia. Yeah,
maybe in Colombia. As far as my own rating goes in comparison to playing kids, I really do kind of think that since my rating's kind of staying the same, I'm not getting any worse. And even if I do lose a little bit to the kids that I play, it's not necessarily because I'm bad at chess. It's just they're getting better, or they need to get rating from somewhere. So there's that.
Yeah, no, I think it's true. And of course, we all have the ultimate objective about trying to measure ourselves by something other than reading, but it, God knows it's not easy. So
absolutely. And so, yeah, Charlotte runs an amazing event. Peter runs a really awesome crew. And the Columbia Chess Club is really inspired by everything that they do.
Excellent. Okay. So listeners, if you're passing through Columbia looking for a place to play chess, or even in the area or moving to Columbia, be sure to look them up. Anything else in terms of like reaching out to you specifically, James, for if listeners are interested?
They can email me at jamesbrandmeier@gmail.com, or they can find me on Facebook. Or they can just talk to my chess club. We're on all the social media as well.
Okay, excellent. Well, James, thanks for giving the trip report. It sounds like a good time, and I hope to see you either at an Alto or another tournament sooner or later myself.
Oh, that sounds great, Ben. Looking forward to it.
Podcast Network.